United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Blessed be the tie that binds. Hello, I'm Jerry Christensen, and this is the Seminary Explores. If you're interested in the Civil War, if you're interested in human nature, and especially in leadership in human nature and the role of religion in the leadership of human nature, especially in the Civil War, this is a program for you. Our guest is Dr. Christian B. Keller. He is professor of history and the General Dwight D. Eisenhower Chair of National Security, the Department of National Security and Strategy at the United States Army War College in Carlisle. And he is the author of a recent book published by Pegasus in 2019, just this year, called The Great Partnership, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and the Fate of the Civil War. People today, even historians, don't often acknowledge that there was a religious connection between Lee and Jackson, besides that wonderful friendship and partnership that they felt about their home state and about the cause of the Confederacy. But religion, how would that be a tie that binds?
That's a great question, Jerry, and thanks for having me on the program. I'd like to state up front that anything that I say is my own words, and it does not represent the official views of the United States Army or the U.S. government or the Department of Defense. So after we've cleared that formality, I can continue. The religious connection between Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson was extremely important. It was important because it cemented the friendship, which underpinned the professional relationship between the two generals. And I discuss all these themes in the book. And one thing I discovered in the course of my research that had been out there since the records had first been printed and had been made available to scholars was that Lee and Jackson approached their Christianity from essentially similar perspectives, though from different denominational backgrounds. Jackson, of course, Blue Light Presbyterian, and Robert E. Lee coming from the Episcopal side of the aisle. They both, however, looked at their faith through the lens of evangelical providentialism. And by that I mean they believed very much that the Lord controlled everything that occurred on this earth, and that there was a modicum of human agency that he allowed to occur for better or for worse. And if good things happened, it was because humans made good choices, and blessings would fall from the Lord as a result of that. If bad things happened, bad choices were made by humans. Of course, God knew all of this in advance, which the providentialists all agreed upon, North and South, regardless of where or when. And Lee and Jackson found, after they became close, which started even during Jackson's Valley Campaign of 1862 through correspondence, and then later when Jackson brings his army east to help defend Richmond in the Peninsular Campaign of June and July of 1862, Lee and Jackson found very quickly that they approached their Christianity from this similar perspective. Jackson was a little less of a believer in the part of human agency in providentialism than Lee. Jackson believed in what I would call a margin of human choice, and he did believe people made decisions for better or for worse, but he believed that there was no question the Lord completely controlled everything. This should not be confused with predestination. Jackson right. comes from a Calvinist background, but he's not a predestinationalist, he's a providentialist. And therefore, he believes that there is a bit of human agency involved, but not nearly as much as Robert E. Lee. And both of them still would give that a minority percentage of the pie. If you're doing a pie chart, the Lord probably has 3/4 of it, and human agency is 1/4. I would say for Jackson, it'd be about 1/8, and Lee would be about 1/4 of that pie as far as what people can do to change their destiny and the destiny of their countries, particularly in war. The significance of this was that the two men were able to find a glue that solidified their friendship. And this, Jerry, is absolutely important. Previous scholars have almost completely neglected this. There are very few who have touched upon it, but they haven't understood what the significance of it was. They haven't looked at the record, I think, straightforward and understood, well, this approach of how they looked at the Lord and they looked at the world and they looked at the war and understood that it was God's will the whole way, with some human agency involved, this made them closer as people, as leaders, which then helped solidify their command team. Lee had a wonderful command team for the first year of the war. For the first year he was in command of the Army Northern Virginia, that comprised Jackson, James Longstreet, and James Ewell Brown Stuart, or Jeb Stuart. The three were a wonderful complementary mix of opposites and a yin and yang, if you will, particularly between Longstreet and Jackson. And this command team was not equaled by anything that the Union armies could produce, at least up until George Gordon Meade takes command right before Gettysburg. And even then, I would argue, as I do in the final chapter of the book, that Jackson's death strongly assists the chances of Union victory and Confederate defeat in what would become the Pennsylvania campaign. I go through a series of analyses about what exactly Jackson's death following the Battle of Chancellorsville meant in a real sense in the context of the day, crazy road towards counterfactual history. I analyze it, what actually did occur, what did it mean, and then what were the likely second and third order effects of his death. Well, one of the most important ones that I found was the effect that his death had on Lee personally. Because Lee and Jackson approached their religion very similarly, because that supported a friendship, their professional relationship was extremely close. So when Jackson dies on May 10th, 1863, 8 days after being shot in the Virginia woods outside of Chancellorsville, accidentally by his own men, I would add, this puts an incredible pall on Lee's demeanor. It is not just a professional blow, which many previous scholars have interpreted correctly. Mm-hmm. It was a personal, devastating blow to Robert E. Lee. And I found evidence in wartime letters and accounts, some of which have been discounted by previous scholars because they looked at the time in which the account was written after the war, and they said it was riddled with lost cause impressionism and that it wasn't therefore an accurate source. Well, I triangulated some of these sources, and I found, even though they may have been written by biased staff members after the war who were trying to tout their chief's memory, and there's no question that did occur at times, that some of these accounts are actually very true. And then when you buttress that with the wartime reaction, both by Lee himself, by others in the Army, both officer and enlisted men accounts, and then you see what the common people, the Confederacy, and the leadership of the Confederacy in Richmond thought. It was abundantly clear that everybody knew Lee was immensely handicapped by the loss of Jackson. And indeed, as the subtitle of the book goes, the fate of the Confederacy was in doubt with the loss of Jackson. A lot of people have long thought about this. It's one of the great what-ifs of history if Jackson had lived, obviously. Without walking the dog too far down a very chancy lane, and we historians shift rather restlessly in our seats when we go too deep down that that road. If you look at this realistically from the context of the time, what did it mean to the South that Jackson was killed, to the White South? The evidence is overwhelming. I was able to look at a lot of newspapers that had been made available online through the Sesquicentennial Projects. I was also able to do a lot of research in Southern archives, looking at letters from soldiers, from officers. The loss was understood to be a strategic inflection point, a strategic level inflection point, that Jackson's loss was not just the loss of a good operator for Lee, but it was devastating to him personally, and it also handicapped his army's efficacy.
The book goes into considerable detail about that.
When you say professionally, a key factor has to be, in light of your thesis for the book, that Lee had to fit this tragedy within a personal view of divine providentialism, which now isn't destroyed, but he's got to struggle to find a new paradigm.
Absolutely correct, Jerry, and it bothers him. He can't reconcile it very well,
yeah.
It's a problem that he has to constantly deal with throughout the rest of the war. There are accounts from 1864, 1865, his staff officers writing at that time, not after the war, who observe Lee's very sad state of thinking about the loss of Jackson, and what does that mean for the cause that he's now fighting for, that he's still fighting for, that he's hoping against hope might win, even with Jackson's absence. There's some very interesting quotes. Walter Taylor, among many of Lee's aides throughout the war, said in 1864 that the star of Confederate fortunes was at its zenith when Jackson succeeded in his flank attack at Chancellorsville on May 2nd, 1863, and it started to descend towards its nadir when Jackson died on May 10th.
Mm-hmm.
He also, another one of Lee's officers, Venable, Colonel Venable, wrote during the Siege of Petersburg in a very interesting letter that was written to one of Jackson's wartime biographers, that there isn't a day that passes, this was a quote, in which Lee does not think of that great and good man, and they're referring to Jackson. I tend to think that had to have been true based on Lee's reaction to Jackson's death, which was extremely heartfelt and distraught. And Lee now has to make this decision after the loss of Jackson. Has God decided to punish the Confederacy? He himself believed, as did many common folk in the Confederacy, that maybe the South was being punished for making an idol of man in Jackson, even as religious and as devoted as Jackson was to God, and how he gave the glory to God and everything. Everybody else gave the glory to Jackson, and Lee himself, perhaps, and that crossed his mind. And if you look at newspaper editorials throughout the South following Jackson's death, that's one of the themes, that perhaps an idol of flesh was set up too much, and too much hope was put in Jackson and not in the Lord. Both Lee and Jackson feared before the campaign of Chancellorsville, and this is in the official records. They wrote to their wives, they wrote to the Richmond government, particularly Lee, with great concern that the Confederate people were putting too much hope in the arm of flesh and not in the Almighty. And therefore, the hard rod was going to come down at some point. And Lee was very much a believer that this might indeed occur. And you have to imagine that when Jackson falls, he probably thought that. But yet, as a good Christian, as a providentialist, Lee is going to carry on because mm-hmm. it's the Lord's will. He prayed about it. We know he prayed every day, and believed that at least up until a period of time that the cause could still perhaps be won. So there you go.
We're talking to Dr. Christian Keller about The Great Partnership, a book he's recently published with Pegasus Press. And we're especially interested in the subtitle, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and the Fate of the Civil War. The thesis of the book is that the two of these leaders shares with a large part of the population of America in the 1860s called evangelical providentialism. Both were deep and firm believers in divine providence, and then had to figure things out as the war went on. I'm Jerry Christensen. You're listening to the Seminary Explorers. Let's generalize out for a minute, Christian, into American religion. My sense is these are two representatives of a broad spectrum of evangelical providentialists across the United States, North and South. And though it's not quite relevant to the book, one of the reasons why they're healing went on after the war was that so many people could sympathize with the great tragedy, the suffering that it, both sides were fought. But in the meantime, the middle of the 19th century was we can call it a kind of deep religion, wasn't it? It was in providentialism, but with a particular bent toward evangelism. Can you explain that a little bit more to me, please?
An excellent point. And there have been some recent works, Jerry, I would commend to the listeners that have come out. There's a wonderful book called The Religious Life of Robert E. Lee, which is written by a good friend of mine, Dr. Cox, who lives down in Lexington, Virginia. That book was extremely helpful in helping me discern what exactly Lee believed in this thing that you've mentioned, and that is a major part of the glue between Lee and Jackson, divine providence. To answer your question, divine providence was one of the great underpinnings of Protestant evangelicalism writ large in the mid-19th century. Presbyterians believed in it, Methodists believed in it, Baptists believed in it, Lutherans believed in it. Probably some of the Catholics believed in it too, at least to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And it was widespread. This is not something that was confined to the fringes. And I'd just like to state that there's this misconception that Jackson was this religious fanatic, which is not at all the case. He just happened to be a little further along on the spectrum, as I write in the book, mm-hmm. than some of his peers. But mm-hmm. I would like to mention that Salmon P. Chase, the Union Secretary of the Treasury, was a providentialist. Unquestionably. All you have to do is look at the second inaugural address. You see the words. And Lincoln clearly believes this. So did Oliver Otis Howard, interestingly, the general in command of the Corps that took the brunt of Jackson's attack at Chancellorsville and also commander of the 11th Corps at Gettysburg. He's extremely devoted to divine providence and a very strong believer. Clearly the Lord saw him through the conflict. But the point is that there was a great number of leaders during the Civil War, and an even greater number, in fact, the majority of white Americans, and I would argue black Americans too, who believed North and South in this concept that the Lord controls everything, that there is some modicum of human agency, but there is a comfort in the fact that the Lord is controlling everything, because it means that if a mistake is made, it is made by humans, that is. It's made for the betterment of mankind and to bring mankind or an individual closer to God, which is what you want to do, mm-hmm. and according to the providentialists. And so there was this sense that we have a sense of security and a sense of calm when babies die in childbirth and when relatives don't live as long as you might like, or children encounter a misfortune, or in the Civil War, as Drew Gilpin Faust has noted in her recent book, when extreme death occurs, there is a way to cope with it because you can give it to the Lord, let him run with it. Yeah. This was his will. This was not the devil taking over. Mm-hmm. This was done for a reason. And this idea that everything occurs for a reason as divinely appointed was a sense of great comfort to people during the Civil War era. It helped them through their lives, and it helped them through the war.
We have only a minute left, Chris, but I do want you to touch at least on the concept of leadership as it applies to what you've learned about the great partnership between Lee and Jackson. It's got to be brief, but at least we should touch on it, because you are, after all, the professor of history and General Dwight D. Eisenhower, chair of the National Security Department at the War College, and you're teaching leadership. What lessons for leadership in here?
The basic point, and I mention this throughout the book, and I summarize it in the appendix, is that for modern teams of leaders today, regardless if they're political, military, business, religious, civic, that there needs to be some sort of underlying glue that will bond the members of the team together. Some people may not want that to be religion. They may find something else, and that's okay for them if that's the case. Others may find that a strong religious faith, whatever it may be, will serve as a glue that can make the team function better, and it will make it function better because it will promote a deep sense of trust among the members of the team, and that is the key. I'll make my final point on this. The Lee Jackson command team was so successful because of the trust that was engendered through the friendship underpinned by the religious conviction that they both shared. And that is an incredibly significant lesson for leaders today that I would remind all listeners to just keep in mind when you're trying to build an organization and lead it. Whoever is at the top needs to have some sort of glue that's deeper than just mere professionalism to persevere through the hard times and to monopolize and to exploit the good times as they're given to us.
Chris Keller is our guest today. He is the author of The Great Partnership, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and the Fate of the Civil War. We've talked about the pervasive nature of evangelical providentialism in America in the middle of the 19th century and its specific effects on two great leaders of the Civil War, Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee, and its continuing importance as a model for leadership even today. I'm Jerry Christensen. For the Seminary Explorers, have a very good day.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.